Lecture 7, Florence, the Creation of the Republic.
I've mentioned so often that the ideas of the Renaissance needed a context, needed an environment in which to grow. The ideas of Petrarch and his contemporaries were themselves elegant ideas, and they were easily flexible. But in order for ideas to take deep root, there has got to be a supportive environment to allow those ideas to flourish, to grow, and to spread. Florence provided the perfect environment for these ideas, in part because it was a very curious place. Florence wasn't a great seaport. It wasn't one of the rich cities that made huge fortunes as a result of the Crusades, like Venice or Pisa or Genoa. But it was an inland city that made a fortune because it had one particular skill: the production of extraordinarily high-quality woolen cloth. This woolen cloth was sought after throughout Europe as being the finest possible, made from the finest wool with the greatest artisan tradition. The production of woolen cloth then made Florence a very, very large city, a manufacturing city, in which tens of thousands of wool workers worked away in unspeakable conditions in order to enrich a small elite of property owners who controlled the wool trade and the spin-off industries that came from the huge amounts of surplus capital that the wool industry created, especially banking. Florence became wealthy because wool was something that it had access to because of its Guelph position. We've already discussed how Florence became the leading pro-Guelph city in central northern Italy. And it was because of this that Florence was able to take advantage of not only the woolen industry, but also the banking monopoly. The Pope wanted to recognize Florence's role and offered not just to give the monopoly for the transfer of sums from all over Europe into the holy city of Rome, but also allowed Florentines to make particular kinds of arrangements and deals with abbots and landlords throughout Europe. Because they had this network, they were able to get the first quality wool. Everything they wanted was easily available because they had the tentacles, the branches, the opportunity, both through banking and through their woolen factories, in order to put things together and create an industry that was truly Europe-wide. Florence was burgeoning in wealth as a consequence. It was expanding enormously. It was becoming richer and richer, and it became more and more influential because these connections were not just economic connections. They could also be used for diplomatic and also intellectual associations. The very wealthy merchants that were produced in Florence, though, found that in the beginning of the Renaissance, they had very, very little power. They were, in fact, new citizens, many of them just first or second generation individuals from the countryside. They had come and they found a city that was dominated still by the old traditional classes. The traditional classes fell into two categories. They were the magnati or magnates. Magnates who were the descendants of the feudal knights who owned vast estates in the countryside as well as fortified palaces in town. And the grandi, the great ones, who were the descendants of the early enriched merchants, those who had made fortunes at the beginning of the explosion of woolen cloth industries, and who, in fact, had intermarried with the old nobility and had adopted most of their attitudes and prejudices. The Guelph-Ghibelline struggle was in some ways a struggle amongst classes, as I've suggested. The victory of the Guelphs and the expulsion of the Ghibellines meant that the power of the magnates was to some extent already reduced. But nevertheless, the Grandi and others who had adopted the Guelph allegiance weren't in any position to necessarily reject the traditions of aristocratic birth and the traditions of a very closed government in which public power resided largely in private hands. It was necessary for Florence then to engage in a new form of government, to begin to experiment with a constitutional model that would allow for some of the ideas that we've been talking about to flourish, but also to allow for this newly enriched, extremely sophisticated, secular, mobile group to have political power commensurate with the taxes they paid and also with the role that they actually enjoyed in the European economy. There are vast opportunities that were available, but they were always restricted because the instruments and levers of power were not available to those who could use them most creatively. There were other elements that added to the wealth of Florence and to the importance of the city in the European economy. In 1237, the florin was introduced. I have mentioned the florin and the ducat as attempts by Italian cities to create a coinage that was stable, not continually being debased and used in order to get a very quick fix of funds by princes or cities always in need of more cash. The Florentines realized that if they had a stable coinage in which the gold content was fixed, they would have a good deal of influence over the European economy because it would be natural that European economic endeavors and indeed long-distance trade endeavors outside of Europe itself could be quoted in florins. So the influence that the pound sterling had before the First World War, or the U.S. dollar today, was an influence that the Florentine florin enjoyed in many ways during the Renaissance. It was an opportunity to, in fact, influence the economy of Europe by providing a coin that everybody knew they could trust. The newly enriched great merchants then had many, many, many ambitions. Their ambitions were in many ways reflecting their economic interest. They wanted a stable coinage. They wanted standard weights and measures that could be enforced. They wanted reliable roads so that they could be sure to get their goods to market and to get raw materials easily into the city. But it was difficult because the government of Florence remained in the hands of the Grandi and those Guelph Magnati who were their allies. It was necessary to deal with this in a profound way, but it was not easy because the magnates had military power on their hands. They were, after all, the descendants of feudal knights. They were trained to fight, and they had a tradition of feudal kin loyalty that was based upon violence and a code of kin behavior that we can associate very closely with vendetta. There was very little the old ruling elites were willing to sacrifice to those whom they believed to be their social inferiors. Remember, these individuals had just a generation or two before had been their peasants or their serfs. Now they were much richer, with much more liquid capital, and the great families didn't much like it. Something had to be done, especially because the traditions of noble violence and brawling had turned the city of Florence into an extremely dangerous, violent place. Vendetta, kin loyalty, the idea that nobles fought almost on principle, meant that Florence was turned into a battlefield between families. It was the world of the Montagues and the Capulets. It was the world where family brawling turned into public disaster. It was also very bad for trade. If the city itself was uncertain, if it was impossible to be confident that your warehouse was secure and that your personal wealth was safe at home, how could you then encourage capital to be formed? How could you encourage there to be long-distance trade and the accumulation of wealth and goods? It was necessary to deal with this, and the merchants had one great advantage with the nobles and the Grandi did not. They were able to cooperate. Mercantile activity, by its very definition, is cooperative. The things that I've mentioned, stable coinage, standard weights and measures, these are the result of cooperative principles. People who realize they have shared needs and values, and they have to consequently be willing to compromise some of their immediate self-interest for general long-term gain. Merchants are used to this. It's the way they function. Moreover, they didn't have that ideology of violence. They didn't have that tradition of kin structure that forced them to make sure that any slight was avenged, usually on the point of a sword. They then began to deal with the magnates and the Grandi in a way that the magnates and the Grandi would easily understand. The control of the communal government of Florence in the hands of the old families tended to be extremely unprofessional. These individuals were not interested in making sure the accounts balanced. They weren't interested in contracts, but the merchants were, and they had these skills. They began, in fact, to ask whether they were able to become involved, to cooperate, to actually convince the magnates that they could play a role, and really not at their expense. The priors then were recognized, and the priors were those who were chosen by the great merchant families. Prior means simply those who walk before. These were the representatives. Those were the leaders of the great cartels of merchants that ran the long-distance economy of Florence. These were the representatives of those seven greater guilds, which were not craft guilds, but more like mercantile cartels. Things like the silk merchants, the apothecaries, the lawyers and notaries, the wool merchants, the cloth merchants, the furriers. All of these capital-intensive occupations, these long-distance trading organizations, chose an individual who would then go forward and then represent not only their interests, but the economic interests of the city in the councils of the traditional noble and grandee families. There were other things that these priors, these representatives of the greater guilds, began to do. They began to take responsibility for contracts, and one of the most important contracts let by the Republic was, in fact, the contract for the podestà. The podestà was always a foreigner, chosen for 1 year, to lead the Florentine armies and the militia. The noble families distrusted one another too much to give military power to any one of them, so they brought in a foreigner to do it. And, in fact, if the foreigner did a good job and the accounts balanced at the end, then that foreigner was able to put his coat of arms on the wall of the Bargello, the palace of the Podestà, that mid-13th century building that survives in Florence to this day. So those coats of arms that one sees when going into that museum of Florentine sculpture are the arms of those Podestà. But it meant balancing accounts. It meant signing contracts. Nobles weren't interested in doing this. They were interested in brawling and fighting on horseback. So the priors took over these responsibilities, and they thereby found that they had military power themselves. This resulted in 1283 in the beginning of the bourgeois coup d'etat that changed the nature of Florence forever. The coup d'etat was begun when the seven priors, representing the seven mercantile cartels, which are called the greater guilds, then got together and said that they would take responsibility for the executive of the government. The executive, though, would be a committee of seven people, all of whom would represent particular points of view, and they would have to rule by consensus. The nobles initially didn't see much problem with this because these people were doing things that they weren't much interested in doing. But it became clear that the intentions of the merchants were very different from the intentions of the nobles. 1289 indicated this clearly. Because the executive of the Florentine commune abolished feudalism and serfdom in the Florentine territory. What this meant to the merchants was that they had an almost inexhaustible flow of cheap labor to work in the stretching sheds and the cloth-making factories and the dyeing factories. What it meant to the nobles is that they no longer had serfs to fight for them, to riot for them when required. They were losing their power base of indiscriminate violence. At almost exactly the same moment, the great nobles won a great victory. The Ghibellines of Arezzo and the Florentine commune fought a battle at Campaldino where the Ghibellines were routed and the Florentines were heroically victorious. The nobles took full credit for this. They were the ones who fought on horseback. They were the ones who led the army. So they, in fact, should be treated appropriately as heroes and they should be allowed to fight and brawl. Well, the merchants didn't really think so, so the nobles brawled even more. The city of Florence became even more dangerous, and something had to be done, and in 1293 it was. On the 18th of January, 1293, the Florentine merchants representing the seven priors, supported by the merchant community within the city, in effect completed the coup d'etat and established a series of laws known as the Ordinances of Justice. These ordinances provided, in effect, the Republican Constitution that would rule Florence for the entirety of the Renaissance and be the context for Renaissance genius to actually operate. It was through the Ordinances of Justice that the Florentine Republic was born, and the Ordinances of Justice turned Florence from a communal government dominated by traditional powers of nobility and great merchants into a republic, a participatory republic, in which a large proportion of the property-owning class could hold office, which there was rotation of office, and which the state could then be used in order to achieve the political and economic and social goals of the new dominant class, which consisted of the mercantile, urban, secular elite. The first thing the Ordinance of Justice did was to bring all property owners into the government. In addition to the seven great guilds, those mercantile cartels we've already discussed, 14 lesser guilds, or arti minori, were added. These lesser guilds were traditional craft guilds. They were shoemakers and barrel makers and belt makers. They were mercers. They were vintners and innkeepers. These were individuals who owned property, employed others, paid taxes, and matriculated in a guild, controlled by guild statute and guild custom. In other words, Florence became a guild democracy. It was a democracy in which only 3% of the population had access to political office. But in 13th century terms, that's a very, very significant proportion. Anyone then who had property, anyone who was willing to subscribe to the rules of the ordinances of justice, could hold office, to be eligible for the highest office in the Republic, that of prior. One of those seven, expanded to nine, who ruled through this executive committee. The more important the office, the shorter the period of time. The nine priors held office for only 2 months, and this was to ensure that no one group, one family, one guild, one economic interest could ever get sufficient power to subvert the state. And it worked extraordinarily well, inasmuch as the Florentine Republic lasted virtually intact, although, as we'll see, with some major changes, including stage managing by the Medici after the middle of the 15th century, but nevertheless remained intact until the 1530s. All the magistracies then were open to any citizen who owned property and who paid taxes. And there were others who were excluded specifically, even if they had matriculated in a guild, even if they were wealthy, even if they paid taxes. All of the magnates and grandi were taken out of political life. They were disenfranchised as a class. They were not allowed to hold office because they were seen as, in fact, dangerous. Moreover, each one of these families designated as noble had to post a bond for not only their good behavior, but for the good behavior of their extended kin. So there was a kind of law established in which those who traditionally could break the law at will now suffered seriously under the restriction of law, and the penalties were severe. Not just loss of your bond, but also if a noble committed a major crime, he was actually punished, something that didn't happen before. And here, too, if we think of the Verona of the Montagues and Capulets, we can see the problem the Duke of Verona had in establishing some kind of order over the brawling of the Montagues and Capulets. Well, in Florence, it was the same kind of situation. There had to be order imposed. So, in fact, if a noble committed a crime, especially murder, then the noble would be punished appropriately under the terms of the law. The nobility and the grandi then were brought under the law and were made subject to it. In order to do this, the very shape of Florence changed, and Florence took on the basic structure and the cityscape that we know today as a consequence of this circumstance. First of all, the great nobles lived in huge fortified compounds, which were topped by tall towers, some of them 75 meters high. These enormous constructions made their owners virtually impregnable. There was no way that any force could break into those tall towers surrounded by fortified palaces. Moreover, the noble families made alliances called tower societies. The towers were linked by underground tunnels or catwalks that made whole neighborhoods suspect to anyone not able to equal those powers. It made entire neighborhoods dangerous for the practice of trade. It made going out at night dangerous. So the towers had to be pulled down. The towers had to be brought to a certain height so that there are no more symbols, as well as no more practical examples of public power in private hands. The bringing down of the towers was symbolic as much as it was practical. It meant that the nobility had to live under the law because they had no protection, a place to put their thugs. It also meant that the symbol of the city was no longer a series of spiky private towers controlled by the nobility. Now all of the city had a similar height. And as we'll see, the towers that did rise were the collective towers of the communal government, representing public power in public hands. Similarly, the building of Florence itself changed as a consequence. There had to be a place where civic government could take place. Previously, government consisted of arrangements amongst the noble and grandi families. It took place in private spaces, in palaces. Now, there had to be a public building, and the great architect Arnolfo da Cambio was chosen to build one. Beginning in 1299, the Palazzo della Signoria was constructed. The Palazzo della Signoria is, to this day, the City Hall of Florence. It is the place where public action takes place. It was a place where the commune was governed. It was a place where the priors had to leave their own homes to live in circumstances that were communal and shared and live consensually and by consensus in that space because they represented the will of the people. The Palazzo della Signoria, now often known as Palazzo Vecchio, but it couldn't be called Palazzo Vecchio until after the creation of the Medici monarchy, and only then the old palace when the Medici moved to the Palazzo Pitti. So I will always call it, until the period of Cosimo I, the Palazzo della Signoria. The Signoria being the collectivity of the Florentine Republican government. The Palazzo della Signoria is surmounted by a tall tower, as it is to this day. That tower represents public power. It represents the power of a commune, of a community over private interests. It's not an accident that it is there. It's not merely an architectural flourish. It represents a symbolic moment of political reality. Similarly, the place where the building was constructed. On that site, there had been the towers and fortresses of the Uberti, a family famous in Dante. The Uberti were the most violent and vicious of all of the noble clans, Ghibelline families that fought viciously on the streets of Florence whenever they could. Their expulsion resulted in the pulling down of all of their palaces and symbolically public space being left so no other could ever build there. The Piazza della Signoria, that huge piazza in front of the Palazzo della Signoria, was the site of the Uberti palaces. Now it is public space for all citizens to enjoy. There was more than a need for public buildings in a secular sense. There was need for also public buildings in the religious sense. The idea of the community in the Renaissance was a Christian community. In fact, in 16th century Italian, popolo can mean parish as well as population. There was then a need for the religious life of the Florentines and their collective spirituality to be celebrated. In order to do this, other architects and Arnolfo were brought in to build great buildings representing not only the preaching orders of the Dominicans and the Franciscans, but also a new cathedral that would celebrate Florence's new wealth. In particular, Arnolfo, who died in 1302, was asked to build the cathedral. The old cathedral of Florence, Santa Reparata, was a Paleo-Christian building. It was in bad shape, it was old, it was far too small for this hugely growing city. And he designed an enormous church, the church that we know today, that enormous cathedral, the Basilica of Santa Maria del Fiore. This church was to be a symbol of the Republic. It was to be a symbol of the spiritual values of the people, and it was also to represent the wealth and size of the city of Florence. It was a place of pride. The cathedral was begun in order to, again, celebrate the power of the people in general. A bell tower was added, a bell tower designed by the great painter Giotto. That bell tower, which rises in the Tuscan style as a separate building beside the cathedral, was visible as well from afar. And it too represents the idea of public shared communal values, in this case religious and spiritual, but nevertheless the idea of communal power as opposed to private power. Similarly, the Franciscan Church of Santa Croce was begun in 1295, Arnolfo again doing the basic design. The facade we see today as the facade in the cathedral dates from the 19th century. Neither church had a facade at its own during the Renaissance. But nevertheless, there still was the building itself, a huge preaching church to allow for the large crowds. This was an age before television, and popular preachers were the great entertainment of the time. The large square in front of the Church of Santa Croce, which is the largest square in all of Florence, was filled with people when a popular preacher preached in that space. The Franciscans attracted the best preachers, as did the Dominicans, and the Church of Santa Maria Novella was similarly rebuilt with a huge piazza in front of it. What we see then is a change not just in the government of Florence, not just in the society of Florence, not just in the economic structure of Florence, but we see a shape in the bricks and mortar and the physical topography of Florence. Florence takes on the image of the city that we know today. It's no longer a city of spiky towers representing public power in private hands. It's now represented by the towers of the people living communally and cooperatively, the towers of the churches, the towers of the cathedral, the tower of the Bargello, which was left intact, and the tower of the Palazzo della Signoria, the town hall where the priors lived. Florence then begins to take on the image of the Renaissance city. We'll see how the idea of turning the city into a work of art and how using bricks and mortar to reflect complex and subtle, sophisticated ideas become part of the Florentine mentality of the 15th century. But the roots of this go right back to the foundation of the Republic in 1293, to the beginnings of those public buildings by Arnolfo da Cambio, the city hall, the cathedral, and the two great preaching churches. Moreover, they've got huge squares in front of them. They have places where people can gather. Unlike the despotisms, which are designed so that people have difficulty coming together in large numbers because rulers often fear their subjects, in Florence, the city was designed to encourage people to come together, to have them come and gather to discuss politics, to discuss economics, to discuss social issues. Florence was, in many ways, a functioning republic in every sense. Certainly only 3% of the citizens could hold public office, but the others had the right, in fact, almost the responsibility, and certainly the pleasure, of talking about politics and talking about society and talking about economics. The dignity of the city, then, was the dignity of its buildings, the success and wealth of its citizens. What we see is that the Florentines were then able to take the instruments of government, the power given to the magistrates who were elected to hold particular office for a particular period of time in order to achieve particular things. The idea of the state itself is beginning to shift. Florence becomes the place where the Renaissance happened first and that cradle for humanism because Florence provided the perfect environment for these ideas to flourish. The ideas of classical antiquity, the ideas of the Republican principles of Cicero could be brought to life simply because Florence, like the Rome of Cicero, was Republican. Social mobility was not only possible but encouraged. The role of wealth was recognized and not seen, as we'll see in a subsequent lecture, as a danger to the soul, but rather something that was part of the public utility and part of the public good. The city itself is a reflection of the community, and the community is not just the sum total of the citizens living together within the walls. The community is a group of individuals who share policy, who have consensual values that need to be extended and need to be reinforced. Community then becomes a sense of mutual responsibility, and the Republican government begins to take more and more of that. And as we'll see again at some length, how in fact the ideas of rhetoric, the ideas that Petrarch found in Cicero and Quintilian and the other classical rhetoricians can be applied in a world where you have got a collective executive of 9 men. How are you going to determine policy but through the application of rhetoric to ensure that your opinion will be heard and that when what is right and just is made clear through rhetorical skill, through the application of words, then policy can be chosen that is good and virtuous. The idea then of the city as a work of art, the idea of Florence as a community of individuals, is something that comes together in a different way. Florence becomes a collective of individuals, to be sure, and we'll talk about many of the greatest of them, but it also becomes a community in itself. It becomes a shared set of values and principles which can be taught, which can be used, which can be applied to the building of a better life on earth. Florence, in some ways, becomes the extension of Petrarch's belief in the validation of human experience, because through its Republican government, through its shared responsibility, through its participatory magistracies, Florentines can create a better world for themselves and their children. They can, in fact, use the instruments of government in order to validate life on Earth and to show that what we do here has validity as much as our search for salvation in the next world.